From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in September, when thousands of students went back to school classrooms in Western New York. It was the first time that most of them had been back in a classroom since March, when, of course, the pandemic shut down in-person learning. We have learned a great deal since September, and we've also seen case numbers rise in our community. Governor Cuomo joins some leading medical experts, saying the best evidence supports having students remain in the classroom when they can, because schools are generally not a source of outbreak or spread. So what's next as we face a pandemic winter, try to get to the back half of this school year, and maybe the final months of maybe the worst of the pandemic? I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, but there's a lot of optimism for the spring. How do we deal with the winter in schools? And by the way, how do color-coded zones impact what schools are doing now? Let's welcome three superintendents of local schools, and I will welcome them now. Kevin McGowan, the superintendent of the Brighton Central School District. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Evan. Happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, sure. Kathleen Groutman, superintendent of the Greece Central School District. Superintendent Groutman, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Evan. Glad to be here.
Aaron Johnson, superintendent of the West Irondequoit Central School District. Aaron, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Evan. Appreciate the opportunity.
Kathleen, because you've worn multiple hats representing an organization with your colleagues and also the superintendent of Greece, I will start with you and just ask if you can, number one, give us a sense for how you think in-person learning is going, all things considered, in January, and also how you have seen the color-coded designations impact schools. Can you do that for us?
Oh, I can do the best I can. I'm sure my colleagues will help, though. In terms of the color-coded designations, both Kevin and I have some experience in terms of having schools that have been deemed orange, which has changed things in terms of our testing protocol at those schools. For me, it's only some of my schools, and for Kevin, it's his whole district. But that hasn't been a huge problem or a lift necessarily, because when we were initially put in yellow, we all sort of got our got experience with testing 20% of our population, and that was where we got some really good original data that our schools are very safe, and that the percentage of our kids who are positive is well below 1% in schools. So I think that was a real positive time for us. And then moving now to orange, because we already had those protocols set up, and the governor relieved us of some of the numbers in terms of only 20% a month, it's a really doable task, and it helps us keep tabs on sort of our percentage in schools. So I say that not to say that any of that has been easy, but just because, because now that we've been through it, I feel like we're in good shape with that. And I think it's also given us some peace of mind around our kids' health and safety in school. So with that, I think the other part of your question was around in-person learning in January. I mean, we've only been back a couple of days now, but I feel like we're in the swing of things. I think, you know, we're in hybrid models in many of our districts and have really clear procedures in place that are safe with kids masked and distanced, and the kids have been amazing. Our teachers have been phenomenal. So I foresee that continuing to go really well.
Kevin McGowan, what's life like in an orange zone for schools?
You know, it's really interesting. I think Kathy nailed it, really spot on in terms of us being able to manage it once we figured it out. And I'd go all the way back to the beginning of this. Every time something seemed impossible, it became entirely possible. Impractical became practical. A lot of really incredible work was done by staff members, administrators, school nurses, you know, people who have put a tremendous amount of effort into normalizing all of this work and keeping kids in school to the best extent that we can. Life in an orange zone, testing 20% over the course of a month, which, you know, really equates to 10% every 2 weeks, is fairly simple. You know, and I know we hesitated, and Kathy, I could tell, hesitated to say it's easy, because we don't want to downplay the effort that's been made by people to make that happen or diminish the fact that people are just knocking themselves out, and those staff members, we wouldn't want to insult them in that way. But I'll tell you, once you get a system in place, once we figure it out, once people get used to these ideas and the kids get comfortable with it and staff members get comfortable with it, these are systems. They are logistics. We do logistics. We transport lots of kids. We feed lots of kids. We teach lots of kids. We test lots of kids. It's just a matter of applying a system to it, and it's worked out relatively well. So that testing aspect for us has gone well, and it's been helpful to know that the infection rate in our schools continues to be exceptionally low.
Yeah, it sounds like you're – maybe easy is the wrong word, but it sounds like you have found a rhythm to what you need to do. Fair?
Yes. Yep, exactly. Very fair to say that.
Yeah, and so let me just follow up with you before I turn to your colleague from West Irondequoit. When you talk about testing and just getting into that rhythm, one of the common questions we get to be blunt, Superintendent McGowan, is what is the test like for the kids? And I think people ask this because probably early on in the pandemic, and even now, some people had concerns or fears about the deeper nasal swab. I'm so used to it. I mean, it's just a thing that's done in about 8 seconds. But I understand for some people who especially who have to deal with it on a somewhat routine basis, they may not like it. And they're wondering if kids are if that's what's happening with kids. So can you just kind of paint a little picture of what it's like when you're having to do it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think let's break this down into three categories. You have some people who have significant concerns philosophically, politically, et cetera. That's one category. I don't subscribe to that, but I respect a different perspective. There's a second category of kids with a tremendous amount of sensitivity to touch, to feel, to certain aspects of the clinical nature of being tested. And they're an entirely separate category of kids and adults that we've tried to work with and work through that, but it's a very small number. For the vast majority, this is as simple and straightforward as can be. Probably much to the later chagrin, at least of my 8-year-old daughter who did a video with me. You know, she'll regret it maybe when she's a teenager, but right now it was great. We put out a very clear, here's how you do it. It's as easy as, maybe easier than picking your nose. And let's face it, in schools, we're pretty decent at that. It's as straightforward, Evan, as a few swipes in the nostril. It's very shallow. It's not at all deep. It takes just a few seconds. And really, it's like itching. I mean, it's nothing. And again, when I say it's nothing, I don't want to diminish those people that have some particular sensitivities. But this particular rapid test is very, very easy. It takes a few seconds. And nobody sticks around, by the way, either. They go back to their classrooms. They're presumed to be negative when they come to school anyways. We don't wait around for results. We take the swab, put it to the side. Everybody goes back. Takes just a couple minutes. Very easy and straightforward.
Yeah, and in so many ways, I'll be honest, I'm grateful for any test that I'm allowed to take. But I also understand the anxiety that some people have, and I hope the superintendent's description is helpful there in illustrating what's going on. Superintendent Johnson, how have things gone since September in your mind?
Well, I echo what my colleagues have shared today. We worked really hard through the summer months and into the fall on our planning and setting up the structures. I think everybody was surprised by how well it went. And again, to Kevin's point, there was a lot of hard work, blood, sweat, and tears that went into that. And now that we're rolling here, I think we're gaining confidence. And part of the testing, you know, that I appreciate is the fact that we're able to sustain and maintain that confidence. I know that we hear that schools are the safest place in our communities. But with that said, you know, there's anxieties because you're sending your most precious people off for the day and relying on the care of the schools. And so I'm all about the testing. Our community has been great. Our staff has been phenomenal as far as supporting that. And it shows in our numbers. We have far more families requesting that their children return back to the hybrid model than we do leaving. And so we're really happy about that.
When it comes to teacher participation is the wrong word. Teacher choosing to not only continue to work in person, but also being able to be there. Kathleen Groutman, I want to go back to what one of your colleagues told me a few months ago when we were just getting started in September, and that's Carm Gamina out in Webster. And Superintendent Gamina was saying, you know, the concern at the time was you have to respect your symptoms and you have to be very careful that if you develop a cough or, you know, a mild fever, I mean, certain signs that something's going on in your body that isn't necessarily COVID but could be. You can't show up in this environment. And his concern was, out of respect for possible symptoms, there may be days that end up being all remote because too many teachers are out. You don't have the staff to do it. And I have not heard of that being an issue, but I it certainly could be, and it could be as we go forward. Has that been an issue? Have you seen any of that?
I know that we've all been concerned about that exact issue, and have been following that really closely. I check in with our principals literally every week to find out sort of how we've done in terms of our fill rate with the substitutes, like what is our percentage of teachers out, all of those things. And the concern is exactly that. If we're saying don't come in, I mean, if you have any of these symptoms, you really have to attest every day that you have your symptom free to come to work. What was that going to do? Interestingly, we have not had a problem, at least in Greece, we haven't at this point. I know that we have some departments that have struggled a bit. So I'll use an example. Like transportation is a unique department because it's much more difficult to find people. I can't just put anyone there as a sub. It's got to be somebody who's certified and who has that training. So when we've had like certain illness that has gone through a particular area and like numbers have been higher, that has made me worried about like, are we on the edge of not being able to transport all of our kids to school? And could that create some kind of a shutdown? We never reached that point, thank goodness, and got through that. But I know that that was an issue in a couple of districts, not just Greece. As far as within the schools, I mean, we've had some days that are tighter than others, but we've really rallied. Our support staff has been awesome in terms of helping to cover classes and then obviously using subs, you know, from the, around the area. But we haven't reached that threshold yet. And we're hoping and we're hanging on. I don't know, Kevin and Aaron, how it's been in your districts.
Yeah, let me ask about that. Superintendent McGowan, have you had any days where you've had to shut down because of staffing issues or related challenges?
No, but I think Kathy describes it well. I mean, you may have a head cook and a backup to your head cook, but do you have a backup to your backup head cook? I mean, these are pretty specialized positions, singleton type positions. Same thing with transportation. It's a good way to think about it. You can't have just anybody sub. And not that you have just anybody sub in a social studies class, but you do have more flexibility in the sense that an administrator can perhaps cover that class, a teacher assistant can at least supervise kids even if they're not providing instruction. So we've had some of the same challenges. We haven't had to shut down at all. We certainly keep a very close eye on it. We've had some, I wouldn't even say close calls, but it hasn't gotten that close, but we've had to be creative in how we cover positions, and we continue to think really deeply about how would we continue operations should that happen, should we have excessive absences in particular areas.
Superintendent Johnson, same question for you.
We're in the same boat. We watch it very closely every day. And we've been very close. You know, I give a lot of credit to our staff, just on the flexibility and their open mindset as far as the approach to that. And, you know, as Kevin said, we have some very specialized positions that we have to fill sometimes when people are unavailable. But people step up and we work together. You know, it's a network of care here. And so we've been able to get the job done. You know, I feel the question here fairly regularly, like, when would we have to shut down? And there's no easy answer to that. I don't know if I can put my finger on that exactly. But when we get there, we're certainly going to know, because we're going to have some of those things that we won't be able to resolve. But so far, it's been so good. So,
well, on that subject, let me follow up with you with a question from a listener named Carrie. And as I do that, I'll let the listening audience know if you've got questions or comments for three local school superintendents. You can call the program. It's toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email questions, comments, connections@WXXI.org. Carrie says, how will the superintendents respond to the possible spread of the more contagious UK variant of the virus, which was found in Saratoga Springs as a likely result of community transmission? It's the same variant which caused the UK to shut down schools this week. That's from Carrie. Superintendent Johnson, are you following news of that? Is that a concern for you?
I am, and yeah, it's a concern for us. I mean, we've talked about that, you know, and we're falling back on our practices that we have established here and the routines that we have in place. And so we know that if we mask with fidelity, if we maintain our physical distance as we should, and we're practicing all of the hygiene and cleaning and disinfecting that that we've come to know and trust, then we're going to continue to be in good shape. And so, you know, I think what we've found was there is a bit of confusion or maybe just a lack of understanding, lack of clarity around what a close contact is and what that means. And so we've been focusing on making sure that we bridge that gap and that we've been providing consistent reminders and supports on how to do that to keep one another safe. And we're just going to continue to track the numbers. And I think that the variable in this whole equation is what's happening in the community. And so what can we do as a school district to help to spread that word and make sure that what we're practicing here at school is being taken home and practicing, being practiced in the household?
Yeah, Superintendent McGowan, when we think about this new variant of the virus, it's clearly a concern about its transmissibility. And for listeners who have heard Dr. Mendoza, Governor Cuomo, leaders like yourselves point to the evidence saying, hey, we don't have evidence of consistent outbreaks or significant spread in schools, which is very heartening to hear. Could that change with this variant? Is that in your mind as we see the next few weeks play out, Superintendent McGowan?
Yeah, I think we look at that very carefully. I think that's a great point, and we do monitor it closely. The three of us just finished a Zoom 20 minutes ago with Dr. Mendoza. He meets with us every week. We couldn't ask for a better partner in him or in Adam Bello in the county executive's office, everybody throughout the county. So we are keeping a really close eye on that. I think in some ways it doesn't change the practices at all. It may just change the circumstances over time. So we're watching and keeping a close eye on our numbers, as Aaron said. It's almost like the speedometer doesn't change. You know, our way of monitoring this doesn't change. The speed may change, and that would require us to hit the brakes when the speed changes, but all of our practices in between don't change. So the distancing, the masking, the same things that we were told we should have been doing from the beginning are the same things they're saying we would do with regard to this new variant. But it really, you know, it could spread faster. We could have higher numbers. We need to keep an eye on that. It would just mean that we'd have to react the way we would have reacted. We just might have to react faster because the spread is quicker. But the actual practices to prevent the spread that have been so successful so far are what we will continue to do because that's what's working.
Superintendent Groutman, are you concerned about this new variant?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that both Kevin and Aaron have said. I think the one thing that I would add on to that in terms of just, you know, doubling down on our safe practices in school is that the other piece that Dr. Mendoza and his office has been phenomenal with is helping to train our people. So my medical director, for example, has been trained around contact tracing. So in addition to what the county's doing, you know, as we have positive cases, we have people internally that are also tracing and checking in with families. So I say that only because I feel like there's this like double layer of check. So if there's any concern about some transmissibility in school, I feel comfortable that we're gonna identify that quickly. We're gonna have numbers to put behind that, and then we're also gonna be able to intervene and do whatever we need. And we've been really clear, and even like Kevin said on that phone call that we have every week with Dr. Mendoza, he was really clear around not only has he been accessible to all of us each week, but then as needed throughout the week. If we have a concern, he's been really clear around he'll shut down a classroom or he'll, you know, talk to us about maybe shutting down a school if we need. So I think if we have any concern, I don't think any one of us is concerned around making that decision and having the support we need to do so just to make sure that kids are safe. But I point out just the fact that they, as a county health department, have been really wonderful about working with the individual districts around like the training needed so that we're not going to miss something.
Well, let me get some listener questions. And Kathy first, she says she has two questions regarding school testing. First, are students still allowed to opt out and how many consistently do so? And are high school athletes being tested on any regular basis while participating in sports? Superintendent Groutman, I'll start with you.
Yeah, we've been really clear around testing is voluntary. A parent has to sign off and basically consent for a child to be tested. That was one of the pieces that was really helpful with the governor. Not only did he allow us to only test 20% a month, but you remember initially when the requirements were 100% of students needed to be tested, which would have meant that everyone would have needed consent. So that was problematic. So to reduce that number down to 20% allows there to be obviously some kids who are probably never going to. So I guess the answer to that question is yes, students can opt out, and that we only test kids who have we have permission and consent from their families. And we, all of us, particularly, you know, as the zones have changed, have gotten more and more. So we have at least gotten more and more families that have opted in. And I think once they saw how not invasive it was and heard from students and families who had it done, and then many of us also had campaigns where we allowed parents to come in with their child to be tested, I think it really demystified it and they realized it was not an invasive, difficult thing. So our numbers have gone way up in terms of the amount of kids who have consented to testing. So that's that piece. In terms of our athletes, we don't have any protocol particularly for athletes at this point. You know, with winter sports happening for us, the only sport that's really going on right now is bowling. So it's a real small number of kids. I know as we consider and think about more sports being added on, if that happens, we may want to consider some other protocols related to athletes. But in Greece, that's not happening with any regularity.
Superintendent Johnson, same questions for you.
Yeah, I mean, I echo everything that Kathy said. You know, for us, that was a relief for us when the governor changed that. And retreated back to the 20%. And, you know, again, as people saw and heard the stories of what the testing was like, and we also added some drive-up testing here in West Irondequoit when we did the yellow zone testing, and we created some opportunities for parents to come in and be there with some of the younger students with the testing. I think that helped to relieve some anxieties. So we will look forward to continuing to have that happen on a voluntary basis. Regarding the athletes, you know, the fall season, I think by all accounts was a successful season for us and really for the county. I didn't hear of any major outbreaks as a result of athletics. Watching the participation, I think our athletes and our coaches did a great job of monitoring themselves and doing what they could to practice the safety precautions that we had in place. We do have a few more athletes competing this winter. We have swimming, and we are going to be competing indoor track. And again, I think applying everything that we've learned through the fall to what we're doing now, I feel pretty confident about that moving forward. But if things change and there's some new guidelines that come down, we'll certainly adhere to those.
Superintendent McGowan.
Same thing. Very cautious around athletics just in general, but similar to our school environment, we have no recorded cases of transmission at all through athletics, so they've done a really great job of following all the protocols. Even in the small group type of team organized workout sessions that we're having, things like that, but there is no testing program. And relative to testing in general, we had, I think it was about 99% at the end, consent to testing. Some consented to the first round of testing and said they were cautious about going forward. This was in the midst of the governor changing the orange zone guidance, thankfully changing it. So it was, you know, a little bit of wanting to test to get kids back into school. Long story longer, the 99% has been helpful. And some people have said in the second round, you know, I'm not really sure, do you have to test my child? Because we're 20% over the course of a month, you're able to move on to other families. So in a sense, it is voluntary opt-in. We're hoping that everybody that gets selected will do it, and if not, we move on to somebody else.
All right, we've got more questions coming in, which we'll take after this only break of the hour. You're hearing Superintendent Kevin McGowan from the Brighton Central School District, Superintendent Kathy Groutman from the Greece Central School District, Superintendent Aaron Johnson from the West Irondequoit Central School District, talking about life in schools during this pandemic and how they're managing, how they're finding a rhythm and trying to make sure they can still offer in-person learning throughout the winter, into the spring, and throughout the rest of the school year. If you've got questions or comments, we'll take them in our second half hour after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson, Wednesday on The Next Connections. Governor Cuomo has been critical of hospital leadership for the slower-than-expected rollout of vaccines. Is that fair? Who's to blame, and what happens next? How complex is the system of vaccine distribution? We expect to hear from the governor as usual, and we will also have a conversation about what comes next with the distribution Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get back to your questions for our guests. And we got a question from Tom who wants to know, what is the length of the average virtual class session compared to the in-person session? It seems like the former is much shorter from what I'm hearing. That's from Tom. Superintendent McGowan, I'll start with you. What is the length of the average virtual class session in Brighton?
Well, it's a complicated answer only in this sense. On Wednesdays, when our district is all remote for all students, there's an abbreviated schedule and the class periods are closer to 30 minutes. On the hybrid days, when other kids are all remote, so that's 20% of our population, so these are full-time all remote students, those kids are attending class, you know, at the secondary level for the same amount of time. So they're on a regular bell schedule at their class. The adjustment on Wednesdays, for a variety of reasons, to give us some different flexibility, and teachers use that time very differently. The sitting looking at a screen is a different way of delivering instruction, so people have made adjustments, and that's across all districts in the region. People are doing some very different things.
Are you, Superintendent McGowan, are you reasonably satisfied with the remote learning that your district has had to do? I mean, I don't expect you're going to say no, but I mean, I wonder if there's a ceiling on the possible quality of learning in remote settings.
Well, I'm sure there's a ceiling, Evan, but I have to tell you, I am really, really impressed, and I think it only gets better all of the time. So it can't replace 100% what happens in the classroom, that magic that our teachers create, the artistry of teaching when a human being is in front of you, and the dynamic of being in a classroom all together. That's a pretty beautiful thing. The remote kind of situation does the Zoom, it creates a different environment, but I have to tell you, they've really figured this out and done a great job. Again, can't replace the in-person, and there certainly is a ceiling, but to the best that they can, I think teachers across the entire region and the state have done a really remarkable job of making that a high-quality experience. Hmm.
Superintendent Johnson, what's the average length of a remote session, Tom wants to know, versus an in-person session? Is it different?
Again, our answer is very similar to Brighton's, and at the upper grades, our remote learners they're zooming in with our other classes, and so it's roughly the same. Everyone's learning remotely on Wednesdays, and the reason for that is really, you know, we're focusing on additional supports on that day, social emotional learning, and so that's a little bit different. The lower grades, again, all the kudos to our teachers. They've been very flexible, really nimble with their thinking, and they're constantly reflecting on their practice. And I think that we've continued to improve in that. And the scheduling, the amount of time that they're spending on task has matured, given the period of time that we're experiencing this. And but really what they've been focusing on is making sure that those students in the K-6 level, they're learning remotely, they have a routine every day. You know, they're spending X amount of minutes on ELA and literacy. They're spending X amount of minutes on math. You know, they're scheduled in when they're coming together on Zoom, and then when they're doing some independent work. And so I think they're hitting their flow at this point. And again, to Kevin's point, nothing replaces that in-person human contact that they have in the classroom, but I think that we're only going to continue to improve on those remote practices as time goes on.
Superintendent Groutman.
Yeah. My answer will be very, very similar. One thing that is a bit different is that we are in a block schedule at our secondary, which means there are longer periods. And what has happened with that, so the kids do, whether they're remote or in-person, they're following a block schedule. The one thing I would say with a longer period like that is our teachers have done, I think they've done an absolutely incredible job, but they also don't have kids always sitting on the call for 80 minutes, following a lecture, because that's not great pedagogy either. So what you'll find and see is that there would be maybe some direct instruction for a period of that time. And then the teacher might actually work with some of the kids in person and have the kids who are remote, you know, maybe either hop off for a little bit or maybe go into another virtual room to work for a little bit. So So not everybody who's sort of observing would necessarily understand exactly what's going on. And then the teacher might pull everybody back for another 15-minute chunk of time. So there's a lot of variation and difference in terms of how teachers are managing that and what that's looking like. But I think to what Kevin said and what Aaron said is they've been incredibly nimble, incredibly flexible, and they're learning. So they're learning different tools and methods and all different ways to try to keep kids engaged while they're on the line. I think that is really important to know, particularly with younger children, because one of the things that we really guarded against and warned against was the idea that I did not want five-year-olds sitting in front of a screen all day long. That's not how five-year-olds are built. It's not appropriate. So it's really important for the teachers to be thinking about, not only do they have kids in front of them oftentimes, but then they've got these kids virtually. How do they keep them engaged? How do they build a schedule like Aaron shared that's appropriate, that's giving them things that they can work on independently while also then connecting and supporting them periodically throughout the day? And the way teachers do that can look a little bit different. So it's hard to give like a pat clear answer to that's really the same, because it does vary a bit.
All right, let me get Robin in Brighton on the phone next. Go ahead, Robin.
Hey, Evan, how are you today?
Good. Go ahead.
Good. I just wanted to make a comment to Dr. McGowan's talking about the remote learning. I have two girls, one high school, one middle school, who are doing fully remote, and they are thriving. They're loving the consistent schedule. I think it's a little more consistent than the hybrid, unfortunately. But they're rocking it this year, and I just – thank you, Dr. McGowan. It's been awesome.
Thanks, Robin, for saying that. I really appreciate it. Kudos to the teachers. And again, thanks for supporting that and your positive comments.
Robin, if you're still there, what are you surprised by that? You know, what has it been like for you as a parent watching them, sort of make this adjustment?
I'm definitely a little surprised. You know, we went into this year knowing we were going to do remote, and talking to the girls about, you know, you're going to be learning like a college student. You know, you're going to have to really gain a lot of independence and manage your schedule and manage your time. And they have just risen to the occasion, and I'm so proud of them. You can't even imagine. So it's been great.
They had to be self-starters for sure. Does that mean, though, that they're going to say next fall, hey, you know, let's just keep doing it this way? Are they going to be ready to be back in the fall?
No, they definitely want to go back, but I think it's also opened our eyes to the different learning styles. I think my older one is really loving not having some of the social garbage that comes with high school a little bit. Mm. So I could see her kind of going, you know, is this another learning option for me? I'm not sure.
I have to say, Robin, social garbage is an interesting way of describing it. And, you know, I'm sort of laughing, musing at that, because I'm thinking of my own 8-year-old, you know, and I'm thinking, boy, you know, it'd be the rhythm of school and the ecosystems of that is school and the socialization probably matters. But you have me thinking, I don't know, maybe we could just get rid of all that emotional stress. There's probably
a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
But there is, you know, for a high school girl, it can be tough. Mm. And so removing all of that, and all she does is learn during that, you know, 5-6 hours that she's schooling. And then she's just, it's so relaxing, very stress-free for her. So it's been great.
Well, I do appreciate the call, Robin. Thank you for sharing the perspective. And on Robin's note here, I do want to ask our guest superintendents from Brighton, Greece, and West Irondequoit if they're... I know what you're going to say. You're all going to say, it's too early, we don't know. But is there anything that says to you at this point that you won't be fully back in the classroom in the fall? Superintendent Groutman, I know you probably hate the question, but
we asked that question. We literally just went through this question today on our call as well.
See, it's a fair question. People are wondering.
It is. And the thing about it is we're planners, and that's our job to make sure that we're ready and that we've considered and thought about all of those options. So I think we torture Dr. Mendoza on a regular basis with questions just like that. And I think we feel pretty comfortable and confident saying that we're going to be back to school in the fall. I think our question is more around, what do you think we'll still be needing to do? So, you know, do we think that there's still going to be a need for masking in the fall? Do we think that there's still going to be a need for any sort of distancing in the fall? I think that the question around bringing our kids back and having more of them back, we feel pretty comfortable that that's going to happen. I think it's just more of with what precautions and what layer. And I think that really is dependent on our community and getting vaccinated. And I think that's going to be the biggest thing from a push perspective and from an education perspective on our side as educators and leaders in the community to really, really push around people getting this vaccine so that we can get herd immunity and that we can feel more comfortable.
Yeah, fair enough. And I'll ask your colleagues about that. As I do kick it over to Superintendent Johnson, I'll remind listeners that when you think about kids getting vaccinated, the state has laid out five phases. You really kind of want to think about kids as phase six because the companies that have created the vaccines have to do new trials involving kids. And some of them have already started that, kids between the ages of 12 and 17, for example. And as you find success, the younger you get, the more you can bring in. Maybe the next wave will be 9 to 12 or 8 to 12. Mm-hmm. And that's just part of the process. How fast that happens? Well, I think we've all been sort of blown away with how fast things have moved with vaccines for adults. So there's a good guess that there will be vaccines, COVID vaccines for kids this year, but we don't know. We don't know when. We don't know the distribution, how fast they can be manufactured, if they will be the same vaccines that adults are taking or if they'll be modified at all. And if they have to be modified, that would probably change the schedule. So there's a lot that has to come into play here before kids can get vaccinated. Now, having said all that, Superintendent Johnson, we know kids get sort of manifested symptoms from COVID less often. Doesn't mean that we don't care. Doesn't mean we're not worried about it. But I think the point of being back in the fall, or at least assuming to be back in the fall, assumes that a lot of the adults in our lives, and especially the most vulnerable adults, will be vaccinated by the fall, which will be a very happy thing, even if the kids are not. How do you see it, Superintendent Johnson?
Well, you know, what we've known, and I think it's been really hammered home here through this experience, is the importance of emotions and really social-emotional learning and our self-awareness and social awareness. And with that, I think hope plays such an important role in what we do. And as Kathy had said, we're going to plan that we're going to be open in the fall. We don't have a crystal ball, but everything is pointing in that direction. And so we're going to plan. We're going to have a backup plan. You know, I think the vaccinations and the herd immunity is critical. That's important, as you've suggested there, Evan. But also, I know that there's conversations happening overseas, and there's been some conversations that have started here locally. You know, the number one, I think, roadblock here is the distancing, right? And so, If we can get to a point where we have enough of the population of the community vaccinated, and maybe there's been some trials and some investigation and research into that distancing, you know, perhaps there's still other precautions in place like the masking, the hygiene, the disinfecting, the sanitization, those types of things. I'm really, really optimistic that we'll be back in the fall, I think that goes a long way.
Superintendent McGowan.
Yeah, so my understanding, very similar. I think my colleagues have explained it well. I think there needs to be a high percentage of our population locally vaccinated for us to achieve some level of herd immunity. And Dr. Fauci and the CDC have put those numbers in different places, but it is a significant number. Even if children aren't being vaccinated at that point, or all of them aren't. The other issue is that vaccinations are not mandatory in this current situation, these types of vaccinations, so that can only be done by statute or by law, and under emergency authorization, it's my understanding that these would not be able to be made mandatory. And, you know, we've had a bunch of different curveballs over the last several years regarding just the mandatory vaccinations in general outside of this that have come up in schools, and having to offer remote, having to plan differently for a hybrid. I think what we probably all would agree on is anything we thought we knew, we didn't know, and any prediction we made was probably not entirely correct in the first place. So it's hard to say right now, other than, yes, we're also in the same place, planning to be fully open, hoping that some type of distancing would be relaxed. That's the biggest issue around having more people in school, but I think that can only be achieved if rates are really low, if many more people are vaccinated, and if it, you know, truly seems to be the safest based on public health guidance, and perhaps that masking would still be in place at that point in time if not enough kids are vaccinated.
Well, and now I want to think about some of your staff members who might be in the more vulnerable category. And I've got a very much a motivated self-interest here. I have not been able to convince my 75-year-old mother not to go back to school and keep teaching and working with kids. She lives in outside Cleveland, Ohio. My mother was hospitalized three times last fall and winter for pneumonia, October, November, and January. That was before this pandemic. So you can imagine I cannot think of a worse person in my life to end up with COVID. But she loves her school community. She tells me, this is why I get up in the morning. This is what motivates me on a daily basis. And it's been a real struggle in my family, but I understand and respect it. I can't drive to Ohio and keep her tied up at home. I mean, it's tough, but I worry every day. And I'm thinking about your staff members who might be either older or more with pre-existing conditions and comorbidities. How much work have you done to make sure everyone feels comfortable about being there? Are there additional precautions? Superintendent McGowan, I'll start with you.
Right. So, you know what's tricky about this is everybody's fear is their reality. And you can never diminish somebody else's emotion or their feelings over these things. They have to decide on that. And I think, you know, trying to convince people, well, you have nothing to be afraid of is disrespectful to their true feelings. I think what we've tried to show over and over again is, number one, we'll do anything that you're asking us to do relative to PPE precautions, making it a workplace that feels more safe to you or is more safe, and just talk to us about that. So creating a trusting, collaborative relationship with your employee units, but your individual employees around taking all the precautions possible, number one. Number two, it's about really following the data and being very clear in the fact that this is simply not being transmitted at school. And so if we look at those numbers, we keep an eye on those numbers, we continue to be cautious about that, be very clear, transparent in our communication. That seems to be helpful also. That doesn't mean that there still is not anxiety. And then with regard to people with legitimate risk and comorbidities, other issues that would require them to have different workplace accommodations, we've granted everyone that we possibly could. And even in cases where the letter of the rule might say, you know what, you really don't have to grant that, we've tried to go above and beyond and give as many accommodations as possible while not sacrificing service to kids either, and find the right balance between those two pieces.
All right. Superintendent Groutman, what would you say to, you know, your employees, or what have you said? What have those discussions been like?
You know, I would echo just about verbatim everything that Kevin just shared. I think, you know, at the base level, there is a relationship with your employees and figuring out who needs what and making sure that there's a pathway and a mechanism for people to be able to share their concerns or wants or needs. Because I think what we have found in this is everybody is so different. There are people like your mom who don't want any accommodation. And then there's people who you know, have a list really, really long and things that, like, we're trying really hard to do whatever we can to be able to keep them because they're saying they want to work. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really just that open, transparent, trusting relationship that's most important. But I think the other piece about it is, while you have some employees that are fearful, I think the other part is we have some who are not fearful. And I think that's the other part that's, you know, where we balance, because they, you know, we've talked a lot with our leadership and principals around being a bit hard on people around making sure they follow procedures. So that's as simple as when teachers gather maybe to have lunch and, you know, making sure people are distanced, making sure they're really following the rules and reminding them and being firm about that, because we don't want to put people at risk. Even if they feel comfortable at the moment with their small little group, we collectively as an organization can't allow for that to happen because we need to make sure everybody's safe. So I guess there's that point around some people are nervous and need different things, and we want to make sure that they can get that. But we also want to make sure that those people that don't have that fear, that we instill and ensure that they're still safe and strict protocols happening and that they're following them too.
Mm-hmm. Superintendent Johnson, you want to add to that, Superintendent Johnson?
Well, again, there's not much to add. I think Kevin and Kathy did a great job of summarizing, you know, where we're at with our schools around some of those fears and anxieties. I think that what I would pull out of that, and just kind of extend is the fact that, you know, the transparency, the communication leading to that trust has been critical for us, and then including people and honoring the voice of some of those individuals. And so as questions have come up, you know, having a mechanism to receive those, for people to file those questions, you know, and really being as open as we can through the process has helped to alleviate that. And I think what Kathy said was a really great point. You know, people are across the spectrum. Our staff are across the spectrum, and some people are really, really fearful to the extent that, you know, they just were reluctant and resistant to come back. Mm-hmm. But they did. They took the leap of faith, and now the responsibility is on the organization to make sure that we're safeguarding those practices, and we're doing our due diligence to just, you know, supervise and manage and make sure that we reinforce the importance and the fact that everybody is coming from a different place with their experiences, their personal health, their family situation, and those types of things.
All right, let me read one more email. John in Pittsford says, how do the superintendents and their districts handle IEPs, individualized educational plans that were created with in-person instruction as a basic assumption? Will special education students receive special consideration or priority for moving back to in-person instruction more quickly? That's from John. Superintendent Johnson?
I think the basic answer is yes, and we've already done that. You know, our self-contained classes, to the most part, are back 5 days a week. We've prioritized that. And, again, when we're looking at space, every inch of our buildings, you know, they've been utilized to the best of our abilities to bring as many students back as we could. And, you know, our students with, you know, the most complex needs and most extensive needs for support have been at the top of that list while balancing the needs of our other students. And we're going to continue to reflect on that and really analyze that. And that's where I kind of go back to as we watch the trend data and in the community infection rates, as Kevin has talked about, you know, we're going to be looking for opportunities where we can continue to enhance those services. And our staff has been phenomenal with that on the front lines in being those direct conduits with the families, constantly checking in and having those conversations with the parents, with the students, and making sure that we're monitoring and adjusting as time goes on.
Superintendent McGowan.
Yeah, I mean, it very much the same thing. We have different arrangements for different kids, and it's really complicated. For the most part, it's 80% of our kids are hybrid, 20 are remote. But in many circumstances, self-contained classrooms, several other special education situations, kids are receiving more in-person time, and then in some particular support services also. So it really depended on the needs of children and our ability to accommodate that. But specifically to IEPs, it's a really good question that the listener asks, because one, the IEPs were created in general with in-person instruction in mind, but all instructional planning really is with in-person in mind. So there's definitely had to been adaptations along the way. And I think people have done a really great job of still honoring the spirit and in most cases the letter of every IEP as they're required to do despite the remote. But I would assume that districts coming back in will think about that, as most have already, to really prioritize particular needs along the way.
And Superintendent Groutman.
Yeah, I would echo exactly what Aaron and Kevin have said. I know that when we designed our program back in August for September, we prioritized our self-contained classrooms. But that's only a portion of our students with IEPs. So we were looking at that from a numbers game in terms of knowing how many students and classrooms we could bring back and still meet the requirements from the state. So I do, and many of us have students with IEPs that aren't in school 4 or 5 days a week. So I know for us, that's one of the things that we think about, particularly as we enter the spring, and if there is a way that we can, and we've said our commitment all along is to bring more students back more days if possible. So we'll be looking to continue to do that. And I will say, for any student with an IEP, that's been closely looked at, and that we're working really hard with families to ensure students' needs are being met.
Well, in our last minute, I just want to make sure I understand the the picture here. So Kevin McGowan just mentioned, I think you said Kevin Brighton is 80% hybrid, 20% remote. Is that roughly correct?
Yep, you bet.
Has that changed since the start of the school year in any direction?
No, really interesting. Every time that we've had a window for people to change, we've had just about the same number of kids asking to come back in as families asking for their children to go out. I'd say just a small, maybe 0.5% difference in this last window as numbers went up. We saw a few more kids asking to go out, but we're talking a very small number.
Okay. Superintendent Groutman, what are the numbers in Greece, real briefly?
We're about 30% remote, but I know December, right at the beginning of December, we surveyed parents who were remote asking if they wanted to come back for the second half of the year, and we had over 300 families indicate that they wanted their students back in a hybrid model or back on campus in some way. So we're planning for basically bringing those students back for the second semester.
All right, and Superintendent Johnson, real quick, the numbers there.
Yeah, we're just under 20% remote K-12, and but interestingly, you know, every time that we've offered a chance for people to make a change in their learning model, it's basically been a 2-to-1, 3-to-1 ratio of the number of people choosing to come back versus go out. So,
yeah, a lot to keep tabs on, and superintendents, I know we've done this a lot, but we've got to keep doing this to make sure the public is well informed, and you're doing a wonderful job of that. Thank you to Superintendent Aaron Johnson from West Irondequoit. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Superintendent Kevin McGowan from Brighton. Thank you, Superintendent.
My pleasure. Anytime. Thank you, Evan.
Superintendent Kathleen Groutman from the Greece Central School District. Always appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan. Glad to be here.
And our thanks to producer Megan Mack, engineer Rob Brayton. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.